president of the Kenyan Cycling Federation had asked me to send some emails from his account to help him really with some logistics or something. And while I had his password and his login to his email, I basically entered myself into the World Championships.
My guest on this episode of Beyond Victory is Chris Froome. Chris is a four-time Tour de France winner, which makes him one of the greatest cyclists of all time. He overcame incredible odds from being raised in Kenya to reaching the pinnacle of a global sport. Cycling is such an intense sport. You have to push yourself to the limit and beyond in every training session and every race to squeeze every single drop of performance possible out of it, much like Formula One. We spoke about this, his struggles and challenges as a child. I learned quite a few valuable lessons from my conversation with Chris, and I really hope you guys can learn a few things too. If you're new to the podcast, please subscribe and give me a cool rating. I'd appreciate that. And just for information, we have a new one coming out every 2 weeks at the moment at 6 p.m. on Mondays. Chris, thank you very much for joining. That's really, really cool. I'm looking forward to the chat. How long was the cycling ride today then?
Today was easy. So today was my
only 6 hours.
I wish. No, today was my recovery day. So I had someone over from Germany looking at my position on the bike, and we were just testing a few different things on the time trial bike and my road bike. So just getting a bit of detail done on one of my recovery days, really.
And how many hours is recovery day then?
Recovery day is generally 1 to 2 hours spinning. The Col de la Madone is just behind Monaco. It's quite a nice climb. I normally go up there on my recovery days and just do it like really nice and slowly and just take in a day where I can just turn over the legs without any pressure or stress.
Let me just fill in the listener about what the Col de Madone is, yeah? Since it's your recovery ride, I sometimes don't even make it to the top because it's our biggest mountain right around Monaco. And it's actually, it's the community race course. So all of us hobby cyclists,
that's cool.
That's where we measure ourselves. Therefore, spontaneously now, I need to ask you for your best time and I'll tell you my best time. I'm actually community champion, by the way. Nobody's ever beaten me up there.
Okay, I mean, I will admit it is a climb where we do go and test ourselves. Often just before a big event like the Tour de France, we'll go up there and we'll go absolutely full gas just to see exactly where we're at. And I think the fastest I've ever been up there is just over 30 minutes, like 30 minutes and 6 seconds. But I'll let you in on a little secret. I know someone else who's gone up there quite a bit faster.
Really?
One of the local pros living around here, but... Yeah.
Really? How is that possible? Because it's just on the short, then they're better than some of the best, or what? Because it's only 30 minutes.
I think it's always, it's very different testing someone on a stage of the Tour de France, say 5-6 hours of racing, and then you have to go up a mountain like that. But if you arrive at the foot of a climb like that, completely fresh, some guys can absolutely turn themselves inside out and fly up those kind of climbs.
Okay, so because it's a bit of a difference, huh?
But here's the real question: what was your time up there?
There you go. Thank you very much. 44:57.
44:57
was my time, and that was 270 watts.
Okay. Wow. So only 50% time off that, and you'll be the pros.
Oh, geez. Do you know your wattage?
It was about 470.
470.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That is unbelievable. Wow. I couldn't even push that for 15 seconds. Unbelievable.
It is my day job, so.
Yeah. Awesome stuff. So if it's okay, I wanted to begin really from your childhood as well, because you came from such a different path than most others.
Sure.
And pretty extreme as well. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I was born in Kenya, grew up there. I always always loved just riding a bike, but it was more transport for me. It was never about racing, or I actually really enjoyed just doing like stunts and tricks and things like that, like jumping around on bikes. But it was never serious. It was never racing. And it was only when I went to school in South Africa as a teenager that I was exposed to the racing side of cycling. I just fell in love with it and had a few friends who were riding at the time, and just one thing led to another, and it just kept on progressing. Each year I'd learn more and more and get better and better, and all of a sudden I found myself racing in Europe.
So I read that actually you were also living in very, very poor circumstances, well, quite poor circumstances, and at some point.
Compared to being here in Monaco right now, it's very different. But I wouldn't quite say it was poor. I mean, I was always had a roof over my head and good food and everything. But I mean, it certainly had a few hurdles to overcome along the way.
But I think that's one point where I wanted to get into actually, which the listeners also maybe can relate with, that you were someone who didn't really wait for the luck to come to you. You're more of an executor who really tries to go looking for the luck yourself. And I think there was a couple of examples. One was how you paid for your first racing, a bit of a wheeler and dealer or something like that. Was there some story there?
I was in the boarding house at school, and actually to buy my first bike, because I was one of the only ones who left the school grounds to go outside to go and ride my bike for training. So I was the only one really who was able to get any contraband that the guys wanted in the boarding house. So anything really, any cigarettes, alcohol. Of course, it'd be a 100% markup on anything. But
so businessman, straight from the beginning.
But it managed to pay for my first bike and my first proper racing bike, and then got into it like that.
Cool. That's a nice and then nice story. And then there was another one where there was a bit of a sneaky edge to it as well. I think where the way you got into your first competition, wasn't that?
So this story is actually the first time I ever got to Europe, because you can imagine as a youngster growing up in Africa, it's like, okay, I've got this dream of becoming a professional cyclist, but how am I going to get a European cycling team to notice me when I'm a kid in Africa riding a bike around Africa? Like, no one's going to pay any attention to anything I do back there. So I wanted to enter myself into the world championships. I figured if I go to the world championships and I train as hard as I can and get into the best shape possible, I'll be able to catch someone's attention there. But to get an entry into the world championships, obviously I'd have to be part of a national team, and I just wasn't on the radar. I wasn't on the system. But I'd been doing some events in Kenya, some local events, and the president of the Kenyan Cycling Federation had asked me, basically his English wasn't very good, and he'd asked me to send some emails from his account to help him really with some logistics or something. And while I had his password and his login to his email, I basically entered myself into the world championships.
How cool
is
that?
So you can imagine this kid from Kenya just pitching up at the world championships on my own, no support team or anything. I just pitched up there, walked into the manager's meeting. I said, yeah, I'm the manager. I sat there, got all the briefing notes and everything of how everything had to happen. Got myself onto the start line, obviously flew down the starting ramp, and after 100 meters I crashed straight into the first commissaire standing on the corner, which was, so I mean, it was definitely a way to make an entrance into professional cycling. But yeah, I mean, it's quite a story. I mean, I think it goes to show again, just that whole my mentality has never been, especially in professional sport, I don't believe anything is given to you for free. I think you have to work extremely hard. You need luck, but you make your own luck as well. So, I mean, getting myself over there was just a start, but I think it just obviously showed how ambitious I was and how badly I wanted to get over.
But I really believe that, yeah, that of course every successful person has had luck along the way.
100%.
But so much of that is you make it yourself. It's really, it's both, yeah?
Yeah.
And I'm very much convinced of that as well.
Have you got any cool little stories about when you got in and things you had to do to get yourself that drive?
Well, of course, I came from a much more privileged background, sure, in that sense, yeah? So, sure, of course, growing up in a wealthy family, So that made things in many ways easier. Yeah, a little bit.
But then I guess also there was a lot more expectation on your shoulders.
Yeah, that's very true. From very early on, everybody was just looking at me and comparing me to my dad, right from since I'm 10 years old.
Yeah,
and
that's tough.
That's true. Yeah. So that's there's one advantage, which is it's easier financially, but then there's the pressure on the other side, which makes it a lot more difficult. And my dad was world champion. So to rise to those expectations is always going to be massively difficult. So that was, yeah, that was quite a
weight. But did you always grow up as a kid, like always like looking at your dad thinking that's what I want to do one day?
Yeah, he was the inspiration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, he was the inspiration because just coming through when I was like 10 years old, I was watching him race and it's just, it was amazing. The cars, the fans, the battling, the racing, the winning. It was just unbelievable. Yeah. And so that's really where my dream also was born.
Started.
To do it myself. How did the inspiration come for you?
No, definitely. And I mean, even going back to the days when I was living in Kenya, I didn't even know what the Tour de France was. I mean, I'd never seen it on television. It wasn't broadcast there. I don't think I really even watched much television when I was growing up there. It was a bit unorthodox. It was the captain of the Kenyan cycling team. I'd gone along to a charity event and I met this guy who, he had dreadlocks. I mean, quite a character, but just like one of those guys who's just so full of life and so just passionate about the sport. And you could see just he passed that passion on to everyone around him. He said to me at the time, he's like, yeah, come join us for a few training rides. And I took him up on the offer, of course, and just fell in love with it. And for me, I think he became that idol for me.
That's also repetitive that there's always these characters that somehow come from nowhere and then become so crucial in the all the rest of the career. Huh? And I often see that as well in successful stories, that suddenly these people come in from nowhere. And so probably an advice can be to really try and embrace those moments when people like that appear. Huh?
I guess 100%.
That's the best message, maybe.
That's it.
And do I have somebody like that? Not really.
Your dad, I guess.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
To an extent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, my father, of course. Yeah, totally. He was, but I didn't really embrace that much. I struggled. Okay. Okay. I struggled to listen to his advice. That was never easy, unfortunately. And do you think that coming from a childhood like that also made you stronger and mentally, or do you think not really, that actually is more in you just genetically that you have this great mental strength?
I don't really know where that drive comes from, if I'm really honest. I mean, I think it's it was just something that a burning desire from when I got bitten by that cycling bug, that I wanted to get into cycling. I wanted to become a professional cyclist. And I was just like, this isn't something I'm going to let slip. I'm going to absolutely give it everything I've got and find a way to make it happen. That's just the way I am. I don't know where I've got that from or how I came about it, but I think, I'm also the kind of personality that when I focus on something, I give it absolutely all of my attention, and it doesn't matter what's going on the sidelines. I can just focus on one thing, absolutely 110%.
That's a great strength, isn't it? To really get rid of distractions then, because distractions are in today's world all over the place, isn't it? So you think that's really something you're good at? Yeah,
top level sportsmen. I mean, I guess you could probably tell me the same about of our drivers. I mean that. You almost have to have that single-minded focus on the sport that you're doing. Otherwise, you're just not going to make it.
I'm not sure. I mean, look at my ex-teammate Lewis Hamilton. I don't know if you follow a little bit what he does. He is all over the shop. I mean, just absolutely all over it. Yeah. I mean, he's doing, in the last race, he was doing Will Smith social media stunts right before the race. Yeah. Like with fans going crazy and this and that, they made a whole movie more or less on social media just before the race.
That's incredible.
Like for me, that would have been unimaginable. Yeah.
I would have
messed up my start 100% guaranteed. And yet he delivers always.
I guess.
So so I think it's not a given.
Yeah. Maybe not a given, but yeah, I guess you have these freaks who stand out and can just do stuff like that.
Yeah. And I think we've seen that in cycling actually too. There's been some who are just so incredibly talented that they can beat the opposition even if they don't have that total commitment and sure. discipline. There's been examples, no?
Would you be able to name one? I'd say someone like Peter Sagan at the moment.
Really? He's like that?
I'd say he's a guy who's probably, I mean, just, I don't know him that well personally, but just from the outside, it looks like he's just all over the place doing all kinds of different things. He's skiing one weekend, mountain biking another weekend, doing like all kinds of random stuff. But then he pitches up at the race and just like kills everyone. So yeah, I guess there are a few freaks out there.
Yeah, no, but it's the same.
The rest of us, we've got to actually work hard and just block everything else out.
Exactly. That's true, yeah. Maybe I wanted to skip over also to one of your great, well, competitors and actually teammates as well, because there's some synergies maybe to the situation that I was in, and that's sure. why it's quite interesting. So the first time you really had a shot at winning the Tour de France, which is your big goal.
Yeah.
You were number two in the team, yeah? And Bradley sure. was then number one.
Yeah.
But you were the better cyclist. And how did the team first of all manage that in that situation? And then what was your decision process as well to then be obedient rather than just say, I don't give it, I don't care. I'm just going to get this win and that's it because I'm the best guy out there.
There were definitely a couple moments when I thought, right, I'm just going to go for it now. But the team orders and the guys calling the shots in the cars were straight on to me and called me back basically.
You could have pulled the plug.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, the difficult part for me was trusting him as the leader. Given that in the last, if you rewind 6 months to the last big race we'd done, so it was the Vuelta a España, the Tour of Spain. So similar to the Tour de France, same 3 weeks, but just in Spain. I'd gone there to support him and he fell apart in the last few days. And then at that point, the team turned to me and said, okay, now you have to try and win it. And I did the best I could, but I ended up coming second by like 13 seconds. And it was just too late in the race for me really to win the overall title. So for me going into that Tour de France, I had this always in my mind thinking, hold on, I am doing the job for this guy, but if he falls apart in the last few days, like I need to be in the best position now to take over again. Like we don't know what's going to happen. And he had never won the Tour de France at that time. I mean, okay, I'd never won it either. But there were a lot of reservations in my mind. And obviously, following team orders was what I had to do at the time. I did do that. I did fall into what the team wanted me to do. And thankfully, we did get to Paris, actually, first and second. He won and I was second, but... Then I had my chance, obviously, in 2013 to go for it 100% for myself.
But in hindsight, everything right, no? Because it's a long game, huh?
Exactly.
And you need the team.
The thing is, I was also quite young at that time. I mean, I had more tours to come. He was at the peak of his career, I guess, and that was his year. So I mean, I think. Being part of a team, you have to make sacrifices here and there, and that for me was one of the sacrifices. I mean, I don't regret it. That's sport. I mean, I think you've been in very similar circumstances, I guess, with Hamilton.
Big time, yeah.
How did you deal with that?
Same as you, really. Just played the long game, and because I also realized that without the team, I'm not going to be able to do anything. Yeah, and if I go against the team early on, then I'm going to have no support when I need it. And so maybe even some of the listeners won't remember, but in the championship year that I had in 2016 in Monaco, I was running second and I was really struggling in the rain and Lewis was third and Ricciardo was going off in the distance. And so the team said, let Lewis pass. And here I am, I'm leading the championship. Yeah. And fighting with the championship just against him because Ricciardo was never going to be a threat.
Yeah.
And they say, let him pass. It was agreed.
That's tough. That's
it was agreed beforehand that every race, the team still has the duty to win that race. Yeah. So even though you're fighting for the championship, higher priority is winning the race.
Okay.
So if one guy can't, then there might be a chance that you need to let him pass to give the other guy the shot.
Okay.
So that was pre-agreed. That made it a little bit easier, of course, but still so hard. And he went on to get the win. So he won that race. I dropped further back and finished seventh. And if I wouldn't have let him pass, he would never have come anywhere close to winning. Yeah? So that was so, so tough. But even in hindsight, totally the right thing. Because I had the full support 100% then from the team behind me. And that is one of those ingredients that are just absolutely necessary to come home with a win in the end, or for you to then win.
If you hadn't followed team orders, do you think that would have made things very, very difficult to sort of basically continue the relationship with the team?
Yeah, I don't know. If I wouldn't, it would have been mainly on management level, yeah? I think everybody below would even have understood if I wouldn't, because I'm fighting for the championship. Yeah. But on the management level, it would have been so hard. And and management level support is so crucial. Because they have to make a decision. You know? They can't equally treat both. And so they're trying to always balance it out. And so it's really important to have their backing. Yeah. So I think it was...
I'd have to agree. Right, because I think pretty much the same for me. Had I gone against team orders there, I would have probably been looking for another team.
out of a job.
That's it.
Let's go into something nice then, really, because it's always special... we have this incredible privilege to experience these emotions of winning. And which most people who are now listening, or you listening, will experience, but in different ways. I think the sporting peaks of you going on the Champs-Élysées and crossing that finish line. Can you just take us through the emotions, if you even remember, or is it all blank from that first time when you achieved your dream of winning there?
I mean, not even just the first time, but I mean, every time. Each of the four times now that I've won the Tour de France, I ride onto the Champs-Élysées and there's no other street or finish or anything like that in cycling where you're filled with the same emotions of, I mean, it marks the end of not only just a 3-week war on the road against other riders, against all the elements, against sometimes crazy fans, all kinds of things. But for everything to go right for those 3 weeks is just, the chances are so slim. And to get it all right is just such an amazing feeling. And getting to Paris, it just marks the end of that, because I mean, just the stress involved, that it's like a pressure cooker. And when you reach Paris, it just feels like everything, you can finally just let go and relax, and it's just the most amazing feeling ever.
So it's relief first, actually,
and then the joy then actually starts to sink in once you cross the finish line. Right. It starts to sink in, like what the achievement actually means, and how many people it touches. So I mean, it's pretty amazing,
pretty powerful, huh? And yeah, for me now retired, I don't think I'm going to find an emotion like that very quickly again. So that's one of the big problems.
What do you find for you was the sort of the moments that stick out in your mind as really like those shining moments? Is it actually crossing the line in the car, or is it standing on the podium, or is it what is it for you?
I have two probably that are most powerful. Is one, winning Monaco for the first time, and there it's really crossing the line.
Yeah.
And it's that moment, the finish line is just passing through and it's done. Cool. And then being in the car on my own.
Yeah.
Monaco, the most legendary, biggest race.
Gosh.
I never had the hugest self-belief, so I never thought I would ever be able to win that. And suddenly I'm there in a Mercedes and I'm winning that thing. And it's my home. Yeah. I grew up here.
Yeah, of course.
And my way to school, where my mom drove me to school every day, is through that tunnel. And so now I'm there leading the Grand Prix race, which I've grown up to watch every year. As a 4-year-old, I'm sleeping in my bedroom and 9 o'clock in the morning, Thursdays, before going to school or whatever, the sound of the V12 engines through the tunnel wake me up. And this is my childhood memory. Ayrton Senna driving through the tunnel with a red and white car with his yellow helmet. Is my first memories. Yeah. And now I'm there and I'm first and I'm about to win this thing.
That's incredible.
That's one of the most powerful moments. Also in the after party afterwards, to be honest, that was pretty good. I think in cycling you're pretty good at partying as well, huh? Everybody thinks, oh no, these guys, they won't touch a drink, but I think I've heard rumors you're pretty good at that as well. So we're okay with that in Formula One too. And the second one was when I won the championship. The first was relief, just as you had. So not the ecstatic, incredible emotions. It was just relief first, because the pressure was gigantic, unbelievable. And then the fun came when my wife came on the radio and said, Moki is how she calls me, we did it. And that clicked suddenly because I didn't expect it. It came out of the blue. Yeah. And it was my first connection with somebody else because I was on my own out there. And then my wife saying that in my ears, that was insane. I can even get emotional again now. That was, that's an unbelievable moment. So those were,
Cool.
You touched on pressure there. So I would like to go into that a bit because pressure, everybody, you who's listening as well, you feel pressure. All of us feel pressure before the job interview or the exam or the project needs to be delivered tomorrow or whatever. Yeah. All of us have it. I would actually most like to go into the one that you get after that first win, because I'm sure that that's when the pressure gets to new dimensions. Yeah. Because then you're not the underdog anymore. You are the guy that the whole world expects. You're the best now. They expect you to win again. Your team expects you to win. All your teammates expect you to win. They're training the whole year to support you to get that win. How does that change for you then? And how do you deal with that?
That's a great question. I think especially when you look at just historically in cycling, when someone's won the Tour de France, it's generally speaking, really hard to back it up the year afterwards because everything changes. It's not just, you don't just go into the winter, have your normal few weeks off and then start training again and you get into things quietly and start your preparations for the next season. The winter, you're being pulled left, right, and center for all kinds of different engagements and events and
distractions,
exactly. and all of a sudden, before you know it, everyone's training again, and you feel as if you haven't even had a break. So you almost need to sort of force yourself back into rhythm, routine, and you start training. And one of the most funny things for me is going to our winter training camp with the team and finding a lot of the younger riders almost like racing you in training, like just pushing you to see basically where, if they're better than you, or obviously you become now the person who everyone measures themselves against. The dynamic changes. And I think all through the season, every race you go to, there's more media, there's more attention on you, and the expectations are higher as well. So you can't just go to the first few races of the season and expect to fly under the radar and I'll build into it slowly. Everyone expects you to win, and if you don't win, they're on your case. Like, why aren't you winning? I mean, you won the Tour de France, so this small race here in Portugal or Spain, or why aren't you winning? It definitely changes. It changes a lot, and I've seen a lot of people really, really struggling to back it up again. And for me, I think the most powerful thing for me to be able to have won the Tour now 4 years and the last 5 or 6 years, I can't even remember how long it's
There's
taken.
Been so many, I can't remember. I can't remember exactly.
It's just trying to block out all this sort of noise on the side, and almost not let myself get too carried away with the achievements. I mean, I'm really not the kind of person who sits here and thinks, I've won four Tour de France's, I've made it, kind of thing. I'm always looking ahead at the next thing, and I don't think I really let myself fully switch off yet. And I think I've got lots of time for that when my career's done. When I'm 14, I can look back and think, that's what I've done. I'm happy now. But right now, when I'm still in this right now, I'm very much looking ahead. And I mean, planning is already well underway for next year's Tour de France.
But this is more your natural side now that you're talking about, I think, which is just you're so damn competitive and just want
Probably.
More and you want another one, and you just cannot accept that. I mean, you want to win that thing, of course, again.
Yeah. I mean, so the big thing for me now is to try and join this club of this very sort of elite group. There's four people who have ever won the Tour de France 5 times.
Yeah.
So I'd be amazing to become the fifth person in that group. And
but doesn't that again put
take
so much
from there?
I mean, if you're thinking about that, that's probably not the best thing, is it? Because that's going to put so much pressure on yourself as well.
It's pressure, but I actually deal really well with pressure. Like, I find pressure, it's fine, it's there, but I just keep doing what I need to do and focused on everything that I need to be doing. So I know what I have to achieve and what's there, what the potential is. But at the same time, I'm not going to let that throw me off or make me make mistakes because of the pressure.
One more time on the pressure. You say these expectations cause more pressure. Why do you care?
Yeah, true. Like, it's I'd have to say, I think the point where you actually physically feel the pressure is, say, a race like the Tour de France starts and you do the first week. Someone else is wearing the yellow jersey. The race hasn't really got too serious yet because you haven't hit the really high mountains. But the second I've always found, the second that I put that yellow jersey on my shoulders, I found then it feels like, okay, now it starts. Your day just gets longer. Recovery time is less. Everyone on the road is like literally looking to how to beat you every day. So that's where I'd say you really feel the pressure. And guys who take the yellow jersey early on in the Tour de France and hold it all the way through, I mean, just chapeau. I mean, it's a lot of pressure there.
So maybe just as everybody listening as well, us sportsmen, we're only human, and we also want to satisfy the expectations of other people who are watching us, I guess.
Yeah, that's sure. I guess that's only natural. Yeah. Only natural that when there are expectations there, you want to fulfill them, and you don't want to be facing those that negativity when you don't fulfill expectations.
Yeah, which all of you also have. Surely your boss has expectations for you listening, or your friends, or whatever. Yeah,
sure.
Similar,
sure.
Just that in sports, it's times 100,000, because it's just huge.
What would you say are the biggest moments for you where you felt, okay, this pressure is actually, I have to take a few minutes here to actually remember to even take a few minutes to breathe, because you just feel as if everything's closing in on you. And yeah. I guess when you're going for a championship, I mean,
that's the one.
That's got to be enormous.
Yeah, that's the one. That was the biggest I've ever felt in sports in general, and couldn't sleep, couldn't eat.
Couldn't sleep even. Okay.
Couldn't sleep, couldn't eat. Okay. And and then you go into this spiral, yeah? Because which then you think, okay, I'm not sleeping, not eating, I'm not going to be able to perform.
Yeah.
I need to sleep, I need to eat.
Yeah.
And it just puts you into this spiral, and then it was like unbelievably demanding, really, really. One of the most difficult circumstances for me to cover. And what really helped me was preparation. Because I, exactly like you, I had, going into that, simplified my life totally. So I'd removed everything. I didn't even have a phone. I had nothing. It was family, racing. There was nothing else.
Okay.
Incredible. Zero. Yeah. No, I didn't look once in social media. I didn't read one news for the last 6 months or 5 months. I was heavy into meditation as well. So I tried to bring in the antidote to pressure, which was the whole well-being, relaxation aspect, and tried to reinforce that as much as possible.
Yeah.
And as you know as well, your recovery is everything. You actually improve your performance in your recovery and cycling, don't you?
That's it.
And that's what, so I put so much effort into the whole recovery and balance area. So meditation, the way I was feeding, the rhythms, the focus, everything. Yeah. And so that's what then gave me that couple of percent more energy, I guess, in those extreme situations.
Cool.
And then I was in that hotel room again yesterday. And the worst thing was that Friday night, going into that last weekend, 3 o'clock in the morning, I finally got like 3 hours where I was able to sleep. And you will not believe it, probably happens once in a lifetime, the halogen bulb from the ceiling, the whole thing, fell onto the sideboard in my hotel room. Unbelievable. No, and woke me up, because it did the biggest smack in the room, like shocked me. I was adrenaline through the
roof. You must have thought.
No, really. What was going on
in that room?
How is this possible? So I got a whole week of hotel free from the manager, because I told him Sunday night. But unbelievable. I mean, that was the only thing that was missing. Yeah. It was this damn halogen light bulb that smacks onto the table next to my bed. Yeah. Unbelievable. Crazy. And I was in the room on my own, because my family was there, but I slept on my own to have really full peace and quiet and everything. And so that's what I did to help. And it worked out. It was just enough.
Cool.
Anyway, low points. I think that's important to cover. Yeah. Is the crashing out of Tour de France one, or would it be something else?
I'd probably say crashing out of a race is probably as low as it gets for us. Something like, obviously, the Tour de France, you spend months getting ready for these events. And if 2-3 days in, you have a crash, and like I did in 2014, day 3 or 4, there's a touch of wheels just in front of me. I slipped and broke my scaphoid on my hand. And it's just like, I got to the finish that day. We taped it up and tried to sort of make a sort of a makeshift splint, because I just didn't. And the next day was actually a cobble day. So on cobbles, it's like probably one of the toughest kinds of stages you could put in a race like the Tour de France. And I still went into that stage with a broken scaphoid. And I told myself that I might be able to hang on and get through, but I crashed twice before we even saw a cobble, just because
crashed twice
just because I couldn't control my bike, because his hand was completely swollen and bandaged up and everything. And that was the second time I crashed on that day. I have to accept that's the last 6 months of preparation is down the drain, and I've just got to cut my losses and start again and focus on the Tour of Spain, which is coming up in the next 2 months. So, I mean, that's the thing with disappointment like that, I guess, as any, and maybe not even only in sport, but in other areas of life, you have disappointments everywhere. I mean, you can't always tell what's going to happen. You can't always plan for these things, but sometimes things just go wrong, and you have to accept when they do, cut your losses and refocus on building back up again. There's nothing easy about it. And sometimes, in my case, I lost a lot of preparation, months and months of preparation, but that's how it goes. And, I'm sure every sportsman has got loads of stories about things that go wrong and, how you overcome that and get back to where you are, especially concerning injuries.
Has sport maybe also taught you, to learn how to come back from low points, in general, probably? Because we just experienced so many extreme ones,
I think so. I always stay so much in the future, always looking ahead. I don't really spend much time dwelling. If something happened last week, if I crashed and got an injury, I don't spend a lot of time really being hung up on the injury or the crash or anything, and
that's strong.
Just put it out of my mind and try and carry on. But I guess everyone's got their own way of coping with things.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a strong asset, of course. Yeah.
Did you ever get any sort of serious injuries from car crashes or anything?
No, I was lucky. I was lucky because I had one big shunt in Monaco here, 2008, in the wet. And just total, because it was hard barrier. There was no tires or anything. So it was just completely into the hard barrier. And that was a big one. Oof. Yeah. And actually, I had a little bit of an eye issue from that shunt, which now came back to haunt me 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
So I had to have a small operation.
Okay.
So it was one of those things that reminded me.
But did that put you out of training and everything at the time?
No. It's
okay.
Probably the doctor said, just relax a bit for a week or so. Okay. But it was okay.
It didn't affect your whole season or anything?
No, nothing major. I think probably your sport might even be a bit more crazy than ours. Ours is pretty crazy. I think you probably take it to the next level.
The speeds you guys go is obviously next level. But I think... given the amount of protection we have with our 2mm Lycra, not much fun when you come off.
And do you sometimes have moments of being a bit scared, or you're just a total nutcase and no fear?
There are a few moments, especially since I've had kids, I think, where you just find yourself on the brakes a little bit more than previously, especially if you're going... For me, when it's dry, it feels fantastic. You can take any corner as fast as you want, almost. But when it's wet and raining, and guys are going close to 100 kilometers an hour downhill, like when you're just using brakes that take like 2-3 seconds to even engage, it's crazy. I mean, you ride so close together, and you just think if one guy comes off, he's going to take 20 people with him. and it's something that's completely outside of your control. So you just have to have faith in the people around you that, that everyone's going to be sensible.
And you do sometimes catch yourself with those thoughts, or you really, or you?
Sometimes you catch yourself thinking, and you do back off a little bit because you just think, hold on, if this guy gets it wrong, all of you are going down. So you find yourself backing off a bit and actually going out to the side maybe and taking a bit of wind instead of being in the slipstream, just so you're safer.
And your family has had, or your kids have had a small...
I'd say since I've had kids, maybe I'm not as reckless as I used to be. I don't think I... it hasn't really changed my racing, but I'd just say I think twice now before going around a blind corner as fast as I can.
Yeah, that's nice. And now kids, family, of course, then just touching on to... I mean, it is a huge sacrifice, isn't it? Still, to be the top in your world of sport, isn't it? And how are you finding that balance? Does it feel you're finding a good enough balance there for yourself?
It's amazing, actually. I mean, I think this is where I have to give huge credit to my wife, because
I know all about that.
I mean, she's just so independent and is basically. Puts up with me being away so much, and she's basically raising two kids on her own. And even when I'm home and I'm in full training, I mean, sometimes I'm sleeping in another room. I get back from training, I'm obviously so tired. I've just done a full day on the road or whatever. I'm not exactly ready to take over and go and play with the kids and stuff. I need to put the feet up and relax or eat or something. So I mean, it's I'd have to say it's got to be tough on her, but she's done an amazing job, and I think thanks to her I can stay pretty much 100% focused on what I need to do to stay at the top of the sport.
So at this point, big respect to all mothers out there listening.
Yeah, definitely.
Unbelievable, though.
This off season, actually, this winter, when obviously I took a few weeks off and I wasn't training, I thought, okay, well, I've got no excuse now. I'm not training every day, so I'll do a few. We've got a 3-month-year-old daughter, so she must have been about a month old. So I thought, okay, I'll take her for a few nights and try and do the night shift. And tell you, I found this huge respect for what mothers go through, because I mean, they literally don't sleep for more than 3 hours at a time. It's incredible.
So the next day you decided to anticipate your the training starts.
Training started again straight away, and
brought it forward by a week.
Brought forward my preparations. No, I mean, yeah, huge respect. It's a massive job.
We have two. We're in a very similar situation, because we have two, and they're, I think, just offset by 1 year. So us is three and 1 year old.
Yeah.
And we, I mean, it's completely maxed out. Yeah. I don't know how mothers do or families do with three. No. I mean, already two feels maximum. Yeah.
Two feels like you're both completely busy all the time. But yeah, I think, I think we're both extremely fortunate to have understanding wives.
And did you start to have that feeling a little bit that you're also looking forward to the time afterwards where it would be a very different life and you would be much more with the kids, or for now not?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think especially as they get older, and as a father, you can actually do more with the kids as they're growing up. I think certainly I'm looking forward to that time, but it's not. I wouldn't say that's the limiting factor on my career or anything like that. So I think as long as I'm enjoying riding my bike and I'm not finding it tough to keep focused on what I need to do, then I'm going to keep doing it for as long as I can.
How are you with your self confidence? Do you have such things as self doubts now as well? Because I mean, last year you didn't manage to win it. You came close, but you didn't manage, and you're not getting younger.
No.
Do you have self-doubts as well into next year?
I don't think there's a professional athlete out there who hasn't had some kind of serious doubt issues along the line. I mean, I think it's almost in our DNA as professional sportsmen to always be questioning yourself and doubting, am I fit enough? Am I strong enough? And I think that's something that probably for me drives me a lot to train even harder and push myself even harder to get ready for the big races.
That's why I covered that actually in one of my previous podcasts as well, that the fear of failure is actually, you can use that as a huge motivator and driving force.
It's a huge positive. It's a huge positive. Yeah. You don't want to be the guy who doesn't make it or doesn't do what everyone expects of you. So it's a strong tool for sure.
So to end this chat, can we see you on the top step then again in the Tour de France?
Listen, I'd love to be there. I mean, it's I'm already starting all the preparations now to get ready for it. So I'm going to give it everything I've got.
We'll be cheering you on. I love the sport. I'm always watching every single year. So
thanks a
really,
lot.
Really, really like it, and it's awesome. really impressive to watch. One more a small add-on. So I just bought myself actually a Van Moof electric bicycle, which is like a Tesla of electric bikes. Is there any really crazy anecdote where you've actually seen someone use? There's so many rumors out there. Someone's actually plugged a little electric engine. Is it real that it's actually happened in professional cycling or not?
There are all these rumors that there are or were professional cyclists who used them in races, but I personally don't see that happening.
Really?
I just can't believe it. Well, maybe I just don't want to believe that I'm there on the start line racing against someone who's got an engine in their bike.
And they still don't have a chance against you.
But no, I mean, actually something quite interesting. So since, as long as I can remember really, since I started getting serious with the big races since 2012, they were already scanning our bikes. So you get to the finish line and they put like a tag on your bike, and that bike can't leave the finish area until it's been fully scanned. And so now they scan them, they put it in an X-ray machine and actually check with all kinds of different sensors and whatever to see if there's any kind of a motor or a hidden engine inside the bike. So I just can't see how anyone could get away with it, but I guess the rumors will always be there.
But if they do these checks, it means that something did happen once upon a time. Usually.
No one's ever been caught, but the checks are there for a reason, and I'm actually quite glad they are there. It stops the temptation, I guess, for anyone who does want to try and put one in.
I just want to cover the Team Sky approach with, it's called marginal gains, but many little gains add up to make a big improvement.
Yeah.
And many of us, and maybe you as a listener also, sometimes don't put effort into the little steps and just try and go for the big ones all the time and miss out on all the little steps.
Yeah.
Can you tell, this is one of the big secrets from Team Sky success.
Definitely.
Can you give two fun examples?
It's something that people really, really take the piss out of us with. It's like, marginal gains. You're going to go and win the Tour de France because you've got a special mattress or something. It's like, come on. But I mean, jokes aside, you think about it. You're moving hotels every single night for 3 weeks during the Tour de France, and some of the hotels, quite frankly, they're like hostels. They're like, there's no space to even open a suitcase inside the room, and there's two of you in there, and the bed is like half the time you've got like a kid's bed or something like that. It's really bad sometimes.
Why don't you use a motorhome that follows you around?
Which would be fantastic. And the team actually came up with that idea as one of our marginal gains. So we rented a bunch of motorhomes, brought them to the start of the Tour de France, and the governing body of cycling went and changed the rules and said,
"No way!
You have to sleep in the accommodation of what's provided for you. Otherwise, it's an unfair disadvantage, and you'll be kicked out the race if you don't sleep in the hotel."
No.
It's become like this running joke now, but seriously, I mean, so the team pack up 8 beds, 8 riders, each rider has their own mattress, pillow, duvet, that travels to every single hotel and goes like ahead of the race, and it's basically waiting for you at the next hotel, so that every night you get the same night's sleep basically. And it's just one of these little things. I mean, recovery is super important. So, I mean, sleep is super important. So why wouldn't you focus on these kind of things? That's just one example. But the team's full of them. If you look at how we do our nutrition and all, there's all kinds of little things where, which we would call marginal gains, but obviously all these little things will help you do your job better. And at the end of the day, make it easier for you as a professional.
Well, that's a great, for sure, one of the important ingredients. Huh? So, dear listener, focus on the small things too, as a conclusion.
Get a good
thank
bed.
You, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Really,
thanks a lot.
Really interesting. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, that was good fun.
And yeah, we'll be watching.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Dear listener, thank you very much for listening in to Beyond Victory. I really hope there were a few learnings you could take away from my chat with Chris. A new episode will be coming out in 2 weeks' time, Monday night at 6. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast, give me a rating if you're new as well, and I really hope you tune in for the next one. Bye-bye.